Welcome to the HPS Cast. I'm your host, Colbert Cannon. This episode marks the end of our sixth season. So first off, thank you so much for coming along with me every week for another great run. It's been a pleasure to share these conversations with you. I hope they gave you some inspiration, maybe some tried and true advice, or just a glimpse into an industry or path that you otherwise would not have known about. Our team is headed into a quick break, but know that we're already working on a whole new lineup of stellar guests and compelling conversations for season 7, which I'm excited to say will be coming your way soon. Until then, take a listen to any of our earlier episodes. We've got over 50 of them, full of insights from industry leaders across the board and across the globe. To sign off, we're taking a quick look back at some key moments. Take a listen. We kicked off the season with game show executive extraordinaire Michael Davies, shortly after he was named executive producer of the absolutely iconic TV game show, Jeopardy. I mean, it's been around in its modern incarnation since the mid-80s, Jeopardy. How do you take something that is so beloved by so many and do more and different interesting things with it?
You know, one thing that I belong to a club out in the East End of Long Island, and a lot of private equity guys there, and I have a lot of friends who work in private equity. And what they always say to me is we're in this golden age of private equity where all these massive firms are holding on to these beautiful businesses, which because they run so many other things and these aren't completely core to their business, they can be sort of picked off, they can really scale and they can be huge. And I think private equity over the last 10 years, we've seen a lot of these sort of examples of this happening. You know, Sony is a massive studio. And part of what has made Jeopardy magic is that it was kept so separate from the rest of the studio. It was protected. And it was this beautiful little time capsule almost that, and part of the reasons it's so magical is that it hasn't changed for so long.
We spoke to John Ridding, CEO of the Financial Times Group, about how he navigated his team through some big distribution challenges at the global publication using one clear vision. So as the leader of the organization for the last 15 or 16 years or so, when you look back on that time, John, what initiatives or growth areas are you proudest of?
Two things, I guess, immediately, but there's probably more. But one was the focus on reaching a million paid for subscribers, which we did, I guess it was 6 or 7 years ago, we finally got there. And why that was important was, for me, it was a lesson in how having a clear North Star for an organization. And I think, you know, quite often corporate strategies are very complicated. And, you know, by the time they reach the people meant to deliver them, what am I doing here? What am I meant to do? And that was super, super clear. What you can achieve through having a single galvanizing, clear, aspirational, motivating goal, like a million paying readers, it really brings together the energy of all of the teams and the whole organization. And we achieved that target a year ahead of schedule. And why it was so important, apart from demonstrating the cohesion and the effectiveness of Team FT, was that I think it marked a fundamental landmark in the transformation of the FT from being dependent on advertising and print to actually having this very strong digital subscription operation.
We had the pleasure of chatting with George Pesha, CEO of the Pesha Group, an international shipping and logistics company. George shared lessons learned from nearly 40 years in the family business, leading it through fleet expansions and global turmoil. Let's fast forward then to the next great challenge. I'm always interested in CEOs' reactions to adverse events. You're running a business tied to auto and retail goods right as the world gets hit with a global pandemic. Tell us about the impact of COVID to your business and how you guys reacted.
So the business today, we're about approximately 2,200 contributors, and over 30 of them belong to collective bargaining agreements. So all of our workers are essential workers. They're all on the front line. And so one of the biggest opportunities and challenges was, how do we continue operating? How do we continue basically moving the metal, but at the same time, create protocols that are going to keep our employees safe, employees on terminals, in trucks, on the ships? And that was quite exciting. And I think one of the things that really served us well is our culture and our attitude, if you will, as a family business. We were very close with our team and with our managers. Everybody's very hands-on. And we just had the right approach in terms of working collectively with the folks on the floor plates and with trust and finding a way together to make the business resilient.
We learned a lot from Mark Machen, former president and CEO of the Canadian Pension Plan Investment Board, one of the world's largest investment funds. So by 2016, you become the CEO and president of CPPIB. During your tenure, if public reports, if I read them correctly, would suggest you generated something like an 11% annual return during your tenure there. That's hard to do on $500, let alone managing $500 billion. When you take a step back, to what do you credit, you know, CPPIB's and your success and stewardship there?
I'd sat on top of an amazing group of people. So we had 2,000 extraordinarily talented people. And that was one of the things that I don't think a lot of people realize. I certainly didn't realize before that the Canadian pension funds could attract such talent. But as a hirer in Toronto, which is a great city, we could pick up the best talent because we were the biggest and most interesting investing business in town. And so we could pick up, you know, fantastic talent. We could put that talent in different places around the world, particularly people who just want to invest.
We got a fresh take on talent acquisition and retention from Adam Miller, HPS's global head of talent. Adam detailed how the scope and value of HR has grown in the finance space since the start of the pandemic and where he sees the workplace evolving. We've had the pandemic, markets are volatile. As you said, the need for sort of the human resources professional and their value is elevated in a pandemic environment. Is that continuing? And what are the lessons out of the last couple of years that are going to be broadly applicable for what you're doing going forward?
Yeah, I think that trend is going to continue. I think if you look at the last couple of years, capital raising is at an all-time high. And what does that mean? People are doing more or bigger deals, and those deals ultimately include people that are part of that business. And because of that, human resources is going to continue to be elevated. When you go in with this predefined investment thesis for this acquisition, a lot of times you need to get the talent thesis right to really optimize value creation. And I think that's really coming together after these last 2 years of the pandemic, when people see that those are not separate, like the people dynamic versus the operational piece are really married together quite nicely.
We had a truly lovely sit down with Danny Meyer, the executive chairman of Union Square Hospitality Group, who shared how he and his team handle operating a collection of fine dining restaurants around New York City alongside Shake Shack, a global fast casual operation. What are the different challenges of running a multi-location fast casual business versus running a collection of fine dining restaurants?
Oh, there's a myriad of differences. Shake Shack is led by a magnificent CEO named Randy Garuti, who came to me as a 22-year-old. He was a GM for us at Tabla, and then he was our GM at the original Union Square Cafe. And when we started creating Shake Shack, and we literally created the Shack Burger and all this stuff out of the private dining room kitchen of 11 Madison Park, Randy said, "This is what I want to do." He was like, "I've had enough of the fine dining stuff. This is what I want to do." You know, Randy knows our culture inside and out and has just found an amazing way to scale it. I can go to any Shake Shack anywhere in the world practically and feel the very type of hospitality culture that we've talked about and lived with all of our restaurants. So language is really the way you scale culture.
We spoke to Grishma Parekh, HPS's co-head of North American Core Senior Lending, about what ultimately drew her to the firm, where she's been key in developing the firm's first private BDC structure, among other initiatives. Grishma, last question on HPS. You mentioned at the beginning, part of the appeal coming here was the culture, and I think you've been lucky to work at a number of institutions with strong corporate cultures. How do you define HPS culture, and what makes HPS HPS?
It's very straightforward. And what I mean by that is everyone here is here because they really enjoy the business of investing and the credit investing in particular. And that's what we do. And so it really simplifies so many of the what sometimes otherwise are complicated corporate dynamics. It's a group of people that are incredibly talented, but no ego, which is also rare to find in our industry and at firms of sort of this caliber. And I think everybody is excited to help one another. And there's an element of, you know, teamwork and camaraderie, both on the investing side and, you know, across the organization and all the other areas that support the investing side of the business.
We talked about the importance of mentorship at every stage of your career with Paul Taubman, the founder, chairman, and CEO of PJT Partners, a global advisory-focused investment bank.
Did learning to be a manager come naturally to you? Did you have mentors for whom you had to spend time sort of understanding? Like, how'd you actually do it?
So one of the first things that I focused on was I said to myself, this is a multi-billion dollar business. If you just think about adjudicating conflicts and making the right decisions and how much is at stake economically to make sure that you make the right decision. And if you look at reputationally, how important it is to always be on the right side in terms of processes and culture to elevate folks to work with me, to support me, who are quite senior and had a lot of experience and a lot of judgment. And when I started PJT, that was one of the first things that I did. You know, there's a saying in baseball, you can't have too much pitching. I think the same thing in investment banking, you can't have too much management because it is a management intensive business.
We had an energizing conversation with Jackie Hernandez, CEO and co-founder of New Majority. Jackie spoke about her career as a leader in the Hispanic media landscape and specifically her time at Telemundo, where she pushed the broadcasting company to go head to head with its main competitor. Well, Jackie, let me understand that a little bit better, because as you say, I mean, forever, Univision was the gorilla in the space, and it's easy culturally to sort of fall into the rhythm of being number two. How do you break that? How do you change that?
So, you know, I think saying to someone, act like number one is one thing, but I think giving them a path and saying, we're going to do programming that's different. We're going to do more rip from the headlines, real life stories, more action adventure. And at the time, in English language television was becoming very kind of edgy. You know, you had Scandal and all these programs out there, but Spanish language television was still very Cinderella. So we're going to move away from that and we're going to create content that's going to reflect the consumer and what they're watching in other languages, but in Spanish. The second piece of it was also giving them a path for here are the efforts that we're doing, the investments that we're making, the strategic initiatives. And one big one for us was acquiring the rights to the World Cup. We knew that would be a game changer. And we had to make the case for it and make the investment for it, but then really have everyone understand why we were doing it.
We sat down with Priscilla Sims Brown, CEO of the largest union-invested bank in America, Amalgamated Bank. Priscilla explains how turning a profit and making a positive impact are not mutually exclusive. You talked in the press at points of doing well and doing good, and I'm personally a believer those are not mutually exclusive goals. But how do you balance the twin demands of profit generation? As you say, you're a public company with public shareholders, you know, with the mission of being socially responsible.
Yeah, we're also a B Corp, which means that we have a stated goal of addressing all constituents and stakeholders in addition to shareholders. But look, I mean, we are doing well through doing good. We're doing good through doing well, meaning we're looking for those opportunities in the market that give us the chance to do something really good, whether that's solar, geothermal, whether that's looking at how to help CDFIs in various communities grow businesses, the work we've done recently around affordable housing and housing for homeless. All of these are doing good in the sense that they're helping society, but they're also good businesses to be in.
We had the pleasure of chatting with Kent Collier, founder and CEO of Reorg Research. Kent explained the difficulties that come with starting a business from scratch and one simple question he uses to help keep his company and product as relevant as ever. When you look back, what are the building blocks from those early days that still matter for you as you think about being the CEO these days?
I would say one of the things that we are very, very focused on as an organization is a customer-first mentality. So I think in the very, very early days, even before I left my job in 2012, I was always talking to customers and asking them, hey, what is something that you do 15 minutes before Reorg? And what is something you do 15 minutes after Reorg? And that has naturally expanded our product portfolio.
That's such a good question.
Yeah. We did not do covenant analysis until 2015, 2016, because people would say, oh, you know, I'm looking at this bond and I'm pulling up the covenant analysis. We should do that. Right? One of the first things we built after we built Pacer is a really powerful SEC technology, right? Which is still one of the most used on Wall Street today. And why? Because people would use Pacer and then they would pull up SEC reports. Like, why can't they do that on Reorg, right? And so one of the things that I'm hyper-focused on is experimenting, doing, because I'm fully aware that I'm going to fail in many, many things, but I don't understand the concept of mistakes. It's either you did something wrong and you learned from it, or you did something wrong and you didn't learn from it, and that is a failure. And that's why we've been able to scale so quickly in 10 years.
And with that, it's time to say goodbye for season 6 of the HPS Cast. Thanks again to all of our guests this season for making it a great one. Check out our show page to listen to all of these episodes in their entirety. This podcast was brought to you by Atwill Media with HPS Investment Partners. Please be sure to rate, review, and subscribe on Apple Podcasts or wherever you like to listen. See you next season.